This is Audible.
Perseus Books Group is pleased to present Six Easy Pieces, Essentials of Physics Explained by Its Most Brilliant Teacher, a lecture series given by Richard P. Feynman.
The Feynman Lectures on Physics. This lecture, Atoms in Motion, was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on September 26, 1961, at the California Institute of Technology.
A poet, I think it is, who once said, "The whole universe is in a glass of wine." I don't know. I don't think we'll ever know in what sense he meant that. Now you say, "Oh, great. Now we just make the quantum electrodynamics with this theory. We make the quantum nucleodynamics using the pions and so on, just like Yukawa wanted to do, and see if it works, and everything will be explained. Bad luck." So you have here 120, 220 divided by 4 is 55. You know, it looks good how fast he does arithmetic, but he's done it before and he checked the number, so I know it's good.
In those days, one of the possible theories that were proposed was that what made the planets go around was that they were behind them here located invisible angels which are beating their wings and driving the thing forward. As you'll see that this theory is now modified. The wavelength is too long. I no longer can take and say, "I saw it." Say, "Well, which hole was it?" I don't know. "Yeah, I saw that one. That was hole number one." Boom. And another one comes through. "I got that one. Hole number one again. Hole number two. Hole number two. Hole number two. One, two, two, two. One, it's on." Therefore, I'm impressing upon you this, that every electron which is recorded can be divided into two classes. Them which come through one, and them which come through two.
By 1960, Richard Feynman was already a legend in his own time, and a young one at that. Though only 42, his research and discoveries in physics had resolved a number of troubling inconsistencies in several fundamental theories. Specifically, it was his work in quantum electrodynamics that was to lead to his Nobel Prize in 1965. At the same time that Feynman was at the pinnacle of his fame, the faculty of the California Institute of Technology was concerned about the quality of the introductory courses being offered to their very gifted undergraduates. It was felt that the introductory physics course was burdened by an old-fashioned syllabus, and that the exciting discoveries of recent years, many of which had occurred at Caltech, were not being conveyed to the students. Thus, it was decided to reconfigure the first physics course offered to students at Caltech, with the goal being to generate more excitement for the students. Who better to teach this course than the most famous physicist and lecturer on campus, Richard Feynman? Apparently, to the surprise of the department, Feynman readily agreed to give the course, though only once. Aware of the fact that this would be an historic event, Caltech tape recorded each lecture and took photographs of every jotting made on the blackboard by Professor Feynman. Based on the lectures and the tape recordings, a team of physicists and graduate students later put together the manuscript that would become Richard Feynman's most widely read and influential scientific work, Lectures on Physics. Even as the two-year course was still being completed, word of it spread throughout the physics community, and by the end of the two-year period, more lectures were being attended by physicists and graduate students than the undergraduates for whom it was originally intended. But the final result was every bit as grand as Caltech had hoped, the encapsulation of the entire field of physics by its greatest living practitioner. Over the years, the book based on the course has been coveted by all aspiring physicists as both a motivation and a brilliant way in which to think about the chief issues of the day. The California Institute of Technology has kept the tapes from the original Feynman course all these years, and they have graciously allowed Addison Wesley to work in partnership with them to provide these recordings to the public for the first time. The editors of Addison Wesley, in consultation with some of the world's leading physicists, have chosen the six easiest lectures to introduce all listeners to the genius of Richard Feynman. Fortunately, Feynman started his course slowly, so although these tapes are filled with substantive science, they rarely refer to equations, and in general, they can be understood by all listeners. The audio quality of the original reel-to-reel recordings from 1961 and 62 left much to be desired by today's standards. The tapes have been resurrected from the Caltech archives and digitally remastered for this series using state-of-the-art technology. Despite these efforts, the tape of the first lecture in this series, Atoms in Motion, suffered from irreparable distortion. Even so, we believe that Feynman fans everywhere will find the segment compelling. We welcome you to these exciting recordings, and now we leave the rest of this course in the very fine hands of Professor Richard Feynman. The Feynman Lectures on Physics. This lecture, Atoms in Motion, was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on September 26, 1961, at the California Institute of Technology.
For 2 years, I'm going to lecture you on physics. I'm going to lecture from the point of view that you are all going to be physicists. It's not the case, of course, but that's what every professor in every subject does. So assuming that you're going to be physicists, we're going to have a lot to study. There's 200 years of the most rapidly developing batch of knowledge that there is. So much, in fact, that you might think that you can't learn all of it in 4 years. And you can't. You have to go to graduate school, too. But the surprising thing is that in spite of the tremendous amount of work that's been done for all this time, it is possible to summarize all this to a very large extent. And that is to find some kind of laws which summarizes all our knowledge. Nevertheless, it's still very hard, and it's unfair for you to start exploring this subject without some kind of a map or an outline of the relationship of one part of the subject of science to another. Therefore, the first three lectures here will be in the form of outlining the relation of physics to the rest of the sciences and the sciences to each other and the meaning of science. Incidentally, each lecture here will begin by some kind of a description of what the point of the lecture is going to be, then the lecture proper will start. Previous to that, there'll be a summary of the previous lecture, the bare minimum from the lecture before that is necessary to keep track of. In the first three lectures, nothing is necessary to keep track of. No notes need be taken because what we're trying to develop is a feel for the subject. Of course, you can take down anything that you find interesting that you'd like to remember, but that's about it. After 2 weeks or so, the copy of these notes will be available. We're going to have some kind of a way of converting these words into print. Now, you might ask, why can't we teach physics by just giving the basic laws on page one and then just showing how they work in all the various circumstances? Something like Euclidean geometry. Here are the axioms and you make all the deductions. Now you're not satisfied to learn it in 4 years, you want to learn it in 4 minutes. Well, we can't do it that way for 2 reasons. First, we don't know all the basic laws. There's an expanding frontier of ignorance. But we still don't know the answer to everything. Second, the correct statement of the laws of physics requires some very unfamiliar ideas and requires advanced mathematics in their description. Therefore, you need a considerable amount of training first in order to learn what the words mean. So it is not possible to do it that way. Therefore, we can only do it piece by piece, or yet each piece or part of the whole of nature is only some kind of an approximation to the complete truth, or the complete truth as far as we know it. In fact, even everything that we know is only some kind of an approximation, because we know that we don't know all the laws yet. Therefore, a great deal must be learned only to be unlearned again, or more accurately, to be corrected. Now, the principle of science, the definition almost, is the following. The test of all knowledge is experiment. Experiment is the sole judge of truth with quotation marks. The quotation marks mean scientific truth or what we accept to be scientific. Anything is judged always by an experimental test. But what is the source of the knowledge? Where do the laws come from that are going to be tested? Experiment too, in a sense, produces these laws, in the sense that it gives hints. But you also need imagination to create from these hints the great generalizations, to guess at the wonderful, simple,
yet very strange patterns beneath it all. And then to return to experiment to check again whether you got the right guess in your imagination. This imagining process is so difficult that there is today a partial division of labor in physics. There are theoretical physicists who imagine, deduce, and guess at new laws, but don't experiment. And then there are experimenters who experiment, imagine, deduce, and guess. Now, I said that the laws of nature are approximate, and we first find the wrong ones, and then we find the right ones. Now, how can an experiment be wrong? First, in a trivial way, that something was the matter with the apparatus that you didn't notice, but these things are easily fixed and checked back and forth. So granting that the minor things are taken. Now, how can a law deduced from experiment be wrong? Only by being inaccurate. For example, the mass of an object never seemed to change. A spinning top, for example, has the same weight as a still one. So a law was invented. Mass is constant, independent of speed. But it is now found to be incorrect. The mass does increase with velocity, but appreciable increases require velocities nearly that of light. A true law is, if an object moves less than 100 miles a second, the mass is constant to within one part in a million. You see, in some approximate form, is a correct law. So in practice, you see, you think that the new law made very little difference. Well, yes and no. For ordinary speeds, we can certainly forget it and use a simple constant law as a good approximation. Yet for high speeds, we are wrong. And the higher the speed, the more completely wrong. Finally, in a most interesting way, philosophically, we are completely wrong with the approximate law. Our entire picture of the world has to be altered when the mass is changed only by a little bit, if it isn't constant. That is the very peculiar thing about the philosophy or the basic ideas behind the laws. Very small effects require profound changes in our ideas. Well, what should we teach first, if we're going to teach? Should we teach the correct, more exact law with its strange and difficult conceptual ideas? For example, in this particular case, the theory of relativity, four-dimensional space-time, and so on. Or should we first teach the simpler constant mass law, which is only approximate, but does not involve such difficult ideas? The first is more exciting and more wonderful, more fun. But the second is easier to get at first, and is a first step to a real understanding of the first idea. Now, this problem arises again and again in teaching physics. And at different times, we'll have to resolve it in different ways. But in any case, it's worth knowing at each stage what we are learning, how accurate it is, how it fits in to everything else, how it may be changed when we learn more. And therefore, in the first three lectures here, we're going to try to give an outline or a general map of our understanding of science today, so that you can, in particular physics, but the other sciences at the periphery, from the point of view that we're taking here. The purpose of these first three lectures, then, is to get a feel for the whole thing so that when we do concentrate and look very closely at a particular point, we have some idea of what the background is and why that particular point is interesting and how it fits into the big structure. So that's the purpose of the first three lectures. In other words, the first three lectures are the main point. What is our overall picture of the world? Now, I'm going to begin this with the first lecture, which is on atoms in motion. If in some cataclysm, all of the scientific knowledge is to be destroyed, but only one sentence is to be passed on to the next generations of creatures, what would be the best thing, the thing that contains the most information in the least number of words? I believe it is the atomic hypothesis, or the atomic fact, or whatever you want to call it, that all things are made out of atoms, little particles that move around or in perpetual motion, attract each other when they're some distance apart, but repel being squeezed into one another. In that one sentence, you'll see there's an enormous amount of information about the world if just a little imagination and thinking is applied. In order to, it's the purpose of this lecture to illustrate that idea, and I do it this way. Suppose that we have a drop of water, say a quarter of an inch on a side, and if we look at it very closely, we see nothing but water, smooth, continuous water. Now, if we magnify with the best microscope, light microscope, I mean, that's available, roughly 2,000 times, then the water would drop would be 40 feet across, about as big as a room or so. And if we look at it closely, we would see that it is, again, a relatively smooth water, but here and there are small football-shaped things swaying back and forth, very interesting. Those are paramecia. And you may stop off at this level and get so curious about the paramecia with their wiggling cilia and twisting bodies that you don't go any further in this particular line, except to hope that you could make the paramecium still larger and see what's inside. This, of course, is a subject of biology, but for the present lecture, I must pass that and go down still further. Looking at the water material itself and magnifying it 2,000 times again. Now the drop of water extends from here to Los Angeles, about 15 miles across. And if you look very closely at it, you'll see a kind of teeming, something that appears, it's no longer smooth, it is something like a crowd would appear at a football game as seen from a very great distance. In order to see what this teeming is about, we magnify it another 250 times, so we'll get a better look at this thing, and we'll see something like what's shown on the first slide. This picture of water magnified a billion times is idealized in several ways. In the first place, the particles are drawn in a simple manner with sharp edges, which is inaccurate. Secondly, for simplicity, I've sketched it almost schematically in a two-dimensional arrangement. But as you must appreciate, these things are moving around in three dimensions, and it's very much harder to draw. So this is not a real picture, but a kind of idealization. I would like you to notice that there's two kinds of blobs or circles here. Those are the atoms. There's an atom of oxygen, which is made in black, and an atom of hydrogen is pictured as a white circle. And you'll notice that each white one has two hydrogens tied onto it. There's another way in which this thing is idealized, and that is that the particles in this picture are really, in fact, are always in motion. They're in a continuous jiggling and bouncing, turning and twisting around one another. So you have to imagine this in a dynamic way rather than a static way. Another thing that cannot be illustrated in a drawing is the fact that they are stuck together, that they attract each other, that this one is pulled toward this one and so forth, so the whole bunch of them are glued sort of together roughly in a big clump. On the opposite hand, they do not pass through each other. If you try to squeeze two of them too close together, they do repel. So we have this picture of jiggling balls bouncing around in the water. As a consequence, of course, that drop of water 15 miles across is now 250 times 15, or from here to Chicago approximately, or bigger. And you can remember the size of these atoms roughly this way. You can either remember that the atoms are from between 1 and 2 times 10 to the minus 8 centimeters diameter. 10 to the minus 8 centimeters is also called an angstrom. So we say, just as another name, so we say there are about 1 or 2 angstroms in diameter. Another way to remember the size is this. If you take an apple and magnify it to the size of the Earth, then the atoms in the apple are approximately the size of an apple. So that's another way. That's either way. You can remember it either way. Now you can imagine then this great drop of water with all these things stuck together and tumbling over each other. The water keeps its volume. It doesn't fall apart because of the attraction of the molecules or the atoms for each other. But if you had a slope For example, that in the tumbling, they can move the whole drop of water from one place to another. The water can flow, but it doesn't just disappear. The things don't just fly apart on account of the attraction. Now, the motion is what we represent, or what we notice, rather, as heat. And when we increase the temperature, we increase the motion. If we heat the water up, the jiggling increases, the banging between the atoms, the molecules, increases all the time, until there comes a time when, in a collision, there's so much speed that it's this pull between them is not enough to hold them together, and they fall apart and become separated from one another. Of course, what I'm describing is the manufacture of steam out of water by increasing the temperature. The thing's flying apart because of the increased motions. So in the next slide, we have a picture of steam. Now it is much more clear how the molecules are formed. This picture of steam fails in one respect. The ordinary pressures, atmospheric pressure of steam, there might be only a few molecules, not very many molecules in this whole room. There certainly wouldn't be as many as three. Most squares of this size would contain nothing. And I accidentally have 2.5 or 3 in the picture, but that's just so it isn't completely boring. You have 3 things to look at. You see, the characteristic molecules are much clearer in the case of steam than they are in the case of water. In this molecule, I've drawn them on the slide so there's a 120-degree angle here for simplicity. In actual fact, the angle is 105 degrees, 3 minutes. And the distance between the center of the hydrogen and the center of the oxygen is 0.957 angstroms. So we know this molecule very well. In fact, we probably know it better, but I couldn't get more accurate figures in the short time available. Now let's see what some of the properties are of steam vapor or any other gas. Because these things, being separated from one another, will bounce against the walls. Imagine this room with a number of tennis balls, or not very many, 100 tennis balls or something, bouncing around in all directions because of the heat that they have, in perpetual motion. Then they, of course, bounce against the walls and bombard it, and this pushes the wall away. Of course, you hold the wall back. That means that the gas exerts a pressure, which in our coarse senses, not having ourselves magnified a billion times, we feel it only as an average push. So in order to confine a gas, we have a pressure. So here's a picture, for example, of a standard vessel for holding gases in all textbooks, which consists of a cylinder with a piston head on it. Well, I don't know why all gases are always contained in cylinders with piston heads, but that's what we will represent here. Now, it doesn't make any difference what the shape of the water molecules are, so for simplicity, I'll draw them as tennis balls or little dots. And these things are in perpetual motion in all directions. So many of them are hitting all the time the top piston, and in order to keep it from being patiently knocked out of the tank, slowly knocked out of the tank by the continuous banging, I have to hold the piston down by a certain force, which I call the pressure, or really the pressure times the area is the force, but never mind. It's clearly the force. Clearly the force is proportional to the area. If, when I increase the area, I keep the number of molecules per cc the same. Now, if I put twice as many molecules in this tank at the same speed, that represents then the same temperature, but twice as number of atoms, that's twice the density, then within an excellent approximation, the number of collisions will be twice as much, and they will be as energetic as before, and the pressure will be increased by a factor 2, so the pressure is proportional to the density. Not exactly, because there are forces between these atoms. There's a certain, when you put too many in there, that one pulls the other back and decreases the force that you'd expect, perhaps, or increases it because they take up each other's room, and so on. So that it's not so easy to tell exactly, but to an excellent approximation, if the pressure is low enough that there are not many atoms, the force is proportional to the density. Now you can see something else. If I increase the temperature without changing the density of the gas, that means if I increase the speed of the atoms, what's going to happen to the pressure? Well, they hit harder because they're moving faster, so the pressure increases. You see how simple the ideas in atomic theory are. Let me take another example. Let's consider another thing. Suppose that the piston is moving down. Well, the atoms are being compressed into a smaller space. What happens when an atom hits a moving piston? If it's moving along like this and it hits a moving mirror or bounces off a moving wall, evidently it picks up speed from the collision. You can try it by bouncing a ping pong ball off a moving bowling ball, for example. And you'll find that it comes off with more speed than it went in. Special example, if it happens to be standing still and the piston hits it, it'll certainly go down. So it's clear that it comes off on an average with more speed than it comes in. Therefore, after a while, the atoms which are in here will have picked up speed. That means that when we compress a gas slowly, the temperature of the gas increases. So under slow compression, the gas will increase its temperature. And then the slow expansion, what? In the case of expansion, if the piston is moving up, then each atom which hits this piston, which is moving out, goes in, if I may crudely speak of it, into a yielding material, a place thing that's going back, and the energy that the atoms have is decreased. Therefore, gas is cool on expansion. Now that's the direction of increasing the temperature of the water. Let's look in the other direction. Suppose that we decrease the temperature. Suppose that the jiggling of the atoms, of the molecules, or the atoms in the water, is slowing down all the time. Now, you know that the forces, there are forces of attraction between the atoms, and after a while, they won't be able to jiggle so well. What will happen at very low temperatures is indicated in the next slide. What happens is that they lock in to a new pattern, can you turn out the lights so we can see the ice better? To a pattern which is solid. In this particular schematic diagram of ice, which is wrong because it's in two dimensions, but is right qualitatively, I have a three-dimensional model here that I'll explain perhaps later. We have the oxygen atoms and the hydrogens, with two hydrogens on each oxygen as before. But the hydrogens are touching each other, and the whole thing is stuck together in a certain array. This is not the exact array. Of course, it's a two-dimensional thing. The exact array, of course, is a three-dimensional thing, and it's hard to portray. The point that's interesting is that the material has a definite place for every atom, and you can easily appreciate that if somehow or other I were to hold all these atoms in a certain arrangement, in a certain place, then because of the structure of interconnections, which is rigid, the other end, miles away, would have a definite location. So if I hold a piece of ice or a needle of ice at one end, the other end resists my pushing it down. Unlike the case of water, in which the structure, because of the increased jiggling, is broken down so that the atoms all move around in all different ways. Then the organization of the atoms in this thing, even if they're held in place, will not pass itself from atom to atom in all directions to the other end. And our little crystal will just sag and drip down as we increase the temperature. So the difference between solids and liquids is that in a solid, the atoms are arranged in some kind of an array. And an array of what is called a crystalline array, a crystalline array. And they do not have a random position at long distances, but the position of some of the atoms that are long distance away is determined by where the atoms are, some millions of miles on the other side of the crystal. Of course, I mean millions of miles at this scale, of course, a small distance in nature. This particular slide is an invented arrangement for ice, and it contains several of the correct features of ice, but it's not the true arrangement. One of the correct features is that there's a pattern of symmetry that's hexagonal. You can see that if you turn this whole picture, I don't mean out the border, but the atoms themselves around an axis, say here, by 120 degrees, for example, then the picture returns to itself. So that there's a symmetry in the ice, symmetry, which accounts for the six-sided of snowflakes, for example. So in there is the form of snowflakes hidden. Another thing that's illustrated by this particular artificial model is the fact that particularly that ice shrinks when it melts. You'll note this particular pattern that's arranged here has lots of holes in it. Now the true ice structure has a lot of holes in it, and when the organization breaks down, these holes can be occupied by the molecules, and so the volume of the water is less than that of ice. Most substances, with the exceptions of common substances or exceptions, are water and type metal. Usually things expand when they melt, because usually the packing is tighter than this when it's cold, and when it melts it needs more room to jiggle around, so that usually it expands. But sometimes when it's an open structure, it collapses when it melts, as it does in the case of water. Finally, I may say that although this is, I keep talking about this as a rigid arrangement, ice temperature can change. Ice has heat, if you wish, and you can change the amount of heat. What is the heat in the case of ice? Well, these things aren't really just standing still there. They're jiggling in place, vibrating, trying to get out of there. All jiggling, like a wiggling all the time, like a, oh, I don't know, you take a mattress springs or something and imagine them all wiggling all the time. So there's a definite order to the thing. It's got a structure, but the things are jiggling in place. As you increase the temperature, they jiggle in place with a wider and wider shaking until the shaking is so wide, so big, that they pull themselves out of place and we get the melting. As you decrease the temperature, the jiggling decreases and decreases until at the absolute zero, there's a minimum amount of jiggling that matter can have. Not zero, but there's a certain minimum amount of jiggling that matter can have. As a matter of fact, this minimum amount of jiggling that things can have in all cases is not enough to melt the thing, so everything is solid at absolute zero with one exception, and that's helium. Helium never solidifies. The minimal jiggling at absolute zero is still enough to keep it melting. So helium at zero temperature even never freezes, unless the pressure is made so high as to help the things to get squashed together. If you increase the pressure, then you can make it solidify. Now that's so much for the description of solids, liquids, and gases from the atomic point of view. But the atomic point of view also describes processes. And so I'd like to go and look at a number of processes to see how they look from an atomic standpoint. The first process that I would like to look at is associated with the surface of the water. What happens at the surface of the water? And this time I make the pictures more complicated and realistic by imagining that the surface is in air. And this is illustrated in the next picture. Here is the surface of water in air. You may notice the water molecules as before, and down here and below is the liquid water. And this is the surface of it. Above, you'll find a number of funny things. First of all, there's some water molecules, like the steam. That's water vapor that's always there above water. There's an equilibrium between the vapor, or steam vapor, and the liquid water, which I'll explain in a minute. But in addition, you'll find some other thing. Here's two black ones stuck together. The black ones are called oxygen atoms, and two oxygen atoms stick together also by themselves, forming another kind of molecule, the oxygen molecule. In addition, there's these cross-hatched things, which are nitrogen atoms, and they stick together in pairs, too, to make a molecule. Air consists almost entirely, with a few impurities of different things, of nitrogen, oxygen, some water vapor, and a few other things, carbon dioxide, argon, and traces of other things. So here's the air, a gas, containing some water vapor. Now what's happening in this picture? The molecules of the water are always jiggling around. From time to time in the jiggling, one near the surface happens to be here, a little higher on the accident, just an accident, a little higher than usual, and gets pushed away. It's hard to say because there's a still picture just what's happening here, but this one has just been hit, for example, and is flying out. Or perhaps this one is the one has just been hit and flying out. So that molecule by molecule, the water disappears, it evaporates. But if we close the vessel above, after a while we have a large number of molecules of water amongst the air. There's nowhere else to go. In other words, if we have a closed vessel, the water, then what happens? Then, let me take this one. From time to time, one of them that's out here comes flying down into the water and gets stuck again. So that what looks like a bed, an interesting thing, a glass of water with a cover that's been sitting there for 20 years, is a dynamic, an interesting phenomenon going on all the time. To our dumb eyes, our crude eyes, nothing's changing. But if you could see it a billion times magnified, you'd see that from its own point of view, it's always changing. Molecules are leaving the surface. Molecules are coming back and forth. Why doesn't it change? Because just as many are leaving as are coming back. So in the long run, nothing happens. If I then take the top of the vessel off, take the glass off, and blow the air away, because I make a stream that sweeps across here and takes away these molecules of water, replacing them just by air, then the number that are leaving is still the same as it was before, because it depends on the jiggling of the water. But the number that are coming back is reduced very much because there are so much fewer molecules above the water. Therefore, there's more out than in, and it evaporates. Hence, you want it to evaporate, turn on the fan. There's something else. Which molecules leave? What molecule leaves? It's because of an accidental extra accumulation of a little bit more than ordinary knocking or banging. Therefore, those that leave have on the average more energy than the average molecule that's in here. So the ones that are leaving take away energy and leave the ones behind with a less average motion than they had before. The more moving ones are the ones that leave. So the liquid gradually cools if it evaporates. Of course, when one comes back, because of the attraction to the water below, when it comes in, there's a sudden great attraction and there's a snapping, in other words, a generation of heat. So when they're coming back, they generate heat. When they leave, they take away heat. And the result, of course, when there's no net evaporation, is nothing. There's no change in temperature. But if I blow it so as to maintain a continuous increase in the number, the more going out than coming in, then the water is cooled. Hence, blow on soup, if you want to cool it off. I also want you to notice that the processes are more complicated. Not only does the water go into the air, but you can imagine among the collisions that from time to time, one of these molecules may come in here, get lost in the mess, and work its way into the water, so that the air dissolves in the water. Both oxygen, which is not illustrated, and nitrogen molecules will work their way into the water, and the water will contain nitrogen. Of course, if we simply take the air away, then these nitrogen molecules will leave more rapidly than they come in, and in doing so, they'll make bubbles. This is very bad for divers, as you well know. When you have a high pressure air that you're breathing, then in the blood, more nitrogen is dissolved ordinarily, because high pressure just means a large density of the nitrogen. So that more of them are going in when it's high. When you decrease the pressure, they try to come out and make bubbles. So that's what happens, and the bubbles are not good for the heart. Now let me turn to another process. On the next slide, we see another process from an atomic point of view. A solid dissolving in water. Suppose that we put a crystal of salt in the water, what happens? Salt is a solid, it's a crystal, and so there's an organized array, which is cubic arrangement here, of salt atoms. Here's an illustration in three dimensions of the salt. Sodium and chlorine. These are, strictly speaking, not atoms, but what we call ions. These are, an ion is an atom which has either got an extra or has lost a few electrons. It has the wrong number of electrons. And this is a chlorine ion. It's a chlorine atom with an extra electron. And this is a sodium ion, that is to say a sodium atom with one electron short. Now they all stick together by electrical attraction in the solid salt. But when you put it in the water, you'll find that because of the attractions of the negative oxygen and positive hydrogens for the ions, there will be gradually in the jiggling, some of these atoms will get loose. Here's a picture of one, the chlorine atom, getting loose. And there they are floating in the water in the form of ions. You'll notice these pictures are made with a great deal of care. You notice some delicate features. For example, around the chlorine, the hydrogen ends of the water are more likely to be there, while around the sodium, the oxygen end, because the sodium is positive and the oxygen end of the water molecule is negative, and they electrically attract, so that that's the way it'll be, and it's more or less realistic. And of course, I can't think of everything, so I can only point out those things which are realistic in the slide. Those things which aren't, I haven't thought of. Now, in this particular case, ion by ion, the sodium is dissolved in the water. How can you tell from this picture? whether this is salt dissolving in water or salt crystallizing out of water, say, which is evaporating, an increase in the concentration of salt. You cannot. Because for a while the atoms are leaving, other atoms are coming down. We still have this dynamic business, just as we had in the case of evaporation. And it depends upon whether there's more salt in the water or less salt in the water than the amount needed for equilibrium. By equilibrium, I mean the rate at which they're leaving shall match the rate at which they're coming back. So if there's hardly any salt in the water, if it's nearly pure water, more leave than come back and the stuff dissolves. If, on the other hand, you've made it so there's too many atoms or too much in the water, then more come down and the thing is crystallizing. Notice that, by the way, if you're interested in molecules, that the concept of molecules is only approximate and only exists for a certain number of substances. Although it's pretty clear in the case of water that those three atoms are stuck together, it's important to say in the case of the sodium chloride where the molecule is. There is no molecule of sodium chloride in the solid. There's just an arrangement of sodium and chlorine atoms in a pattern, the cubic pattern given here. If we increase the temperature, we increase the jiggling, then the rate at which the things are taken away is increased. But so is the rate at which the things are brought back increased. And it turns out to be quite difficult in general to predict the general law as to which way it's going to go. When you increase the temperature, whether you're going to dissolve more or dissolve less. Most substances dissolve more, but some substances dissolve less. So we can't tell, but we can guess that it'll change one way or the other, because it would be an accident of the greatest form if, when you increase the rate of jiggling, the rate at which they jiggle loose and the rate at which they work their way back happen to be balanced, changed both the same amount. Both rates are, of course, increased, but the question is which increases the most. Now, in all the processes which I've described so far, the atoms or the ions have not changed partners. That is, we have here a molecule of water with two oxygens and a hydrogen. We pointed out there was something like oxygen, which was two atoms of oxygen alone. But there are circumstances in which the atoms take up new combinations, forming new molecules. This is illustrated in the next slide, a situation in which the rearrangement of the partners occurs. This is what we call a chemical reaction. The others we call a physical process, but there's no sharp distinction between these things. Nature doesn't care what we call her. She just keeps on doing it whatever way she wants. Now, this is supposed to represent carbon. I didn't bring a crystal of carbon. It's diamond, for example. If you want to burn a diamond in air, you can't, but you're kind of dopey. Now, here's burning an oxygen. I've simplified. I haven't got air. This is the oxygen. Now, in the case of oxygen, these two oxygen atoms stick together very strongly. Why not three? Why not four stick together? That's one of the very peculiar characteristics of interatomic forces. They're very special, and they like certain particular partners in certain particular directions and so on. And it's the job of physics to analyze why each one wants what it wants. But at any rate, it forms saturated or happy, a pair. The carbon atoms in the crystal, which would be the graphite or diamond, looks like this. Now, for example, one of these can come down to the carbon and each one pick up a carbon atom and go flying off in a new combination, carbon-oxygen, which is called the gas carbon monoxide, one oxygen for each carbon, and is given the chemical name CO. It's very simple. This is practically a picture of that molecule. The carbon attracts the oxygen much more than either the oxygen attracts the oxygen or the carbon attracts the carbon. Therefore, when this happens, this may come down with a small energy, but it may be able to pick up these things, and they will snap together with a tremendous vengeance and jiggle. And anything else near them will pick up the energy away, because if you hit something that's jiggling hard, you pick up an energy. So there's a large amount of motion energy, kinetic energy in the gas is generated here. This, of course, is burning. We're getting heat out from the combination of oxygen and carbon. The heat is in the form, ordinarily, of the high motion of the gas, hot gas. But, of course, in certain circumstances, it can be so enormous that it generates light. And so you get flames out of this. In addition, the carbon monoxide is not quite satisfied. It is possible for it to attach another oxygen. So we might have a much more complicated reaction illustrated here, in which the oxygen is combining with the carbon, But we're not sure, and at the same time, there happens to be a collision of a carbon monoxide here, and we're not sure whether this oxygen is going to end up attached to this, on this one to that, or how. But this could attach itself to this and form this molecule, which is one carbon and two oxygens, which is made in the form CO2, and this carbon dioxide. If you've got enough oxygen present and you burn it continuously, you keep the reaction going, form all dioxide ultimately. But if you burn the thing with very little oxygen and do a very rapid reaction, like in a gas, for instance, in an automobile engine, where the explosion is so fast, there isn't time for it to make much oil carbon dioxide, and a considerable amount of carbon monoxide comes out. The main difference between this and other processes is the fact that new partners are formed to form new molecules, and this rearrangement is called a chemical reaction. And most interesting, in such rearrangements, a very large amount of energy is released, forming explosions and flames and so forth, depending on the reactions. Many chemists have studied these arrangements of the atoms and find that everything can be understood. Everything is some kind of an arrangement of atoms. And to illustrate this, I would like to just take an example of something else. If we go in a field and smell violets, for example, what that smell is some kind of a molecule or arrangement of atoms that's worked its way into our nose. So, first of all, how does it work its way? Well, that's pretty easy. If some kind of a molecule or arrangement of atoms were to come off of the violet, since the gas has all the atoms pretty far apart, it can, jiggling around and batting all over, accidentally work its way into the nose. There's no particular desire to get into the nose. It's merely the jostling crowd of atoms in the air, and this particular chunk of stuff working its way gradually up happened to work its way into the nose. Now, the chemists can take special molecules like the odor of violets and analyze it and tell you the exact arrangement in space of the atoms. Just like we know that the carbon dioxide is a straight line from here to here, that can be determined easily by physical methods too. But in the very much more complicated arrangements of atoms that there are in chemistry, by a very remarkable process of detective work, you can find the arrangements of the atoms. First, let me illustrate the picture of what it looks like over a violet, what the air looks like in the neighborhood of a violet. That's illustrated in the next slide. Here is our nitrogen and oxygen of the air. What's that? A water vapor. What's it doing? Well, the violet was wet. I mean, all plants transpire, and so there's some water vapor in the air. And then there's this monster. The white circles are carbon atoms, the little circles are hydrogen atoms, and the black circle is an oxygen atom. And these gentlemen have picked a certain particular pattern for them to arrange. It's much more complicated than carbon dioxide. It's an enormously complicated arrangement. Unfortunately, I cannot really picture all that is known about it chemically, because it is actually known in three dimensions, the precise arrangement of those atoms. That is, whether, for example, you see, I draw it in two dimensions, but this carbon and that one may be turned this way relative to this carbon and that one, and so on. And these six carbons which form a ring here do not form a flat ring, but a kind of puckered ring. And all the angles and distances are known to, say, a percent in this particular case. However, for the excitement of the thing, I unfortunately made this slide some almost 9 years ago. And it turns out that my respect for chemistry was a little bit exaggerated, because they since found that they had made a slight error in the arrangement of violets. However, I'll tell you what the error is. It's not very great. But I want to point out that what a chemical formula is merely a picture of such a molecule. When the chemist writes this thing on the blackboard, he is trying to draw, roughly speaking, this. He's not drawing it exactly in three dimensions, but tells you which atoms are touching which. So I have, for example, a ring of six carbons, a chain of carbons hanging out the end. And so you see a ring of six carbons and a chain of carbons hanging out the end with an oxygen second from the end, three hydrogens tied to that carbon. two carbons and three hydrogens sticking up here and so on. So the chemist in writing this formula has discovered the arrangement of the atoms and the shape of the molecule. How does he do it? He mixes bottles full of stuff together, and if it turns red, it tells him it's a group of one carbon and three hydrogens tied on here. If it turns blue, on the other hand, that's not the way it is, and so on. This is one of the most fantastic pieces of detective work that has ever been done, organic chemistry. To discover the arrangement of the atoms in these enormously complicated arrays by looking at what happens when you mix the different substances together. The physicist never quite believed that the chemist knew what he was talking about when he told the arrangement of the atom. And in more or less recent years, in 20 years, 30 years, it's been possible through electron diffraction to kind of look at such molecules. Not quite as complicated as this, but ones which contain parts of this. And it's been possible to locate, sometimes nowadays, yes, even as complicated as this, and it's been possible to locate every atom by a physical method that has nothing to do with mixing and looking at the colors, but by measuring where they are. And lo and behold, the chemists are almost always correct. Incidentally, I must apologize for this particular one, the order of violets being wrong. It turned out that they had an error in analysis, and I picked the wrong molecule. I should have picked one 9 years ago that they knew better. At any rate, the correct picture of the order of violets is given here. It's the same ring as before, same chain as before. If you look closely, you'll see one difference. There's an extra CH3 tied on here. There's a rearrangement of the hydrogens. There's none here, and there's an extra one here, and so on. But it's very close to the way it was before. And I'm sorry I could have made a new slide and not embarrassed the chemists. The substance that I've drawn here is alpha-methanol. It turns out that there are, from the latter, three different molecules which have a slight difference in the arrangement of the hydrogen atoms. That's all. Minor shifts to hydrogen atoms to the other form. Now, an important problem in chemistry is to name the substance so you know what it is. Find a name for this shape. And when you appreciate the problem of finding a name for a shape, more than a shape even, not only must you get the shape, but you have to tell which is, this is an oxygen, not a nitrogen, exactly what they are. You need a name for the shape and the particular location of the atom. And so you can appreciate that the chemical names must be complex if they're complete. And so you see that the name of this thing in a more complete form that will tell you the form of it is 4-2236-tetramethyl-1-cyclohexanol(3-butene-2-one). And that tells you that this is the arrangement. But you can appreciate the difficulties that the chemists have and also appreciate why the names are so long. It's not because they want to be obstinate, but because they have an extremely difficult problem to describe this thing in words. Why they don't just draw the pictures all the time, I don't know. It seems to me easier. Now, how do we know that there are atoms? By all of the effects that I talked about, we made a hypothesis that there are atoms, and one after the other, things come out the way we say they ought to if they're made out of atoms, and that's the most of the evidence for atoms. There is somewhat more direct evidence. A good example of that is the following. The atoms are so small that you can't see them with a light microscope, an ordinary microscope. In fact, even today, with an electron microscope, you can't still see individual atoms. But with a light microscope, you can see something that's much bigger. Now, if the atoms are always in motion, say in water, and I put a big ball of something in the water, much bigger than the atom, that ball will jiggle around, much like a push ball in that big game of a great big ball, a lot of people on it all pushing in various directions, and the ball moves around the field in an irregular fashion. So in an irregular fashion, a very large ball will move because of the accidental inequalities of the collisions on one side or the other. A few more hit on one side than the other at a given moment, and the ball starts moving this way. Then it quickly changes its mind and so on. Therefore, if you look at very tiny particles of dirt, well, of stuff, of different things, colloids or something, in water, through an excellent microscope, you can see a perpetual jiggling of the particles, which is a result of the bombardment of the atom. That's the most direct evidence for the atom, and I hope that it will be possible to arrange in a laboratory to set up a microscope so that you can take a look at these vibrating atoms. I have here arrangements of the various, some of the different kinds of solids Here is a solid that's a little more complicated, which is calcite, and the actual crystal of true calcite sits here, and you can see the relation between the shape of the crystal and the shape of the arrangement. Here is another arrangement that the chemists are using to study the arrangement of the atoms and various molecules. This is about as complicated as iron. It happens to be an amino acid important in living things called tyrosine. But it's merely illustrative of what we know about the atom. Now, everything is made out of atoms. That's the key hypothesis. The most impressive hypothesis in all of biology, for example, the most important hypothesis is that everything that animals do, atoms do. In other words, that there's nothing that the living things do that cannot be understood from the point of view that they're made out of atoms jiggling according to the laws of physics. This has not been so evident from the beginning. It took some experimenting to suggest this hypothesis, and now it is accepted and is the most useful for producing new ideas in the field of biology. If a piece of steel or a piece of salt consisting of atoms, one next to the other, can have such interesting properties. Or take water, which is nothing but these little blobs, mile upon mile of the same thing repeated on and on, forms waves and foam and makes rushing noises and makes the funny patterns as it runs over cement. If all of this, all the life of a stream of water can be nothing but a pile of atoms, how much more is possible if instead of arranging the atoms in some definite pattern, again and again repeated on and on, or even in little lumps of complexity like the order of violets, we make an arrangement of atoms which is always different from place to place, with different kinds and so on, in other words, in numerous ways, continuously changing, not repeating. How much more marvelous is it possible that these things behave? And is it possible that this thing that walking back and forth in front of you, talking to you, is a great glob of these things in a very complex arrangement, and that the sheer complexity of it staggers the imagination as to what it can do. So that when we say I am a pile of atoms, I do not say I am merely a pile of atoms, because a pile of atoms which is not repeated from one to the other might well have the possibilities which you see before you. Thank you.
This lecture, Basic Physics, was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on September 29, 1961, at the California Institute of Technology.
This is the second of three lectures whose purpose it is to acquaint you with the position of physics or science in general, what our view of the world is. And in this lecture, I'm going to tell all of the ideas, the fundamental ideas that we have in physics. You'll find the summary of the previous lecture on this board, always. I want to discuss the nature of things as we see it at present time. We're not going to discuss the history of it or how we know that all this is true, but only what we found out to be true. You'll learn all the details in due time, but in the meantime, we have a very rough, very rapid sketch through everything. So the name of this lecture, the second lecture, is The Present Situation in Basic Physics. Now, the things that we concern ourselves with in science appear in a myriad of forms and in a multitude of attributes. For instance, if you stand at the seashore and look out, then you see, of course, the water, the waves breaking, the foam, the sloshing motion of the water, the sounds, the air and the winds and the clouds, and the sun and the blue sky and light. And there's sand, and there's rocks of various hardness, permanence, color, and texture. There's animals in the sea and seaweed. There's hunger and disease. There's the observer standing on the beach. Maybe there's even happiness and thought. Any other spot in nature has a similar variety of things and influences. It's always as complicated as that, no matter where you look. Curiosity demands that we ask questions, that we try to put the things together to understand this multitude of aspects as perhaps the action of a small number of elemental things.
or things and forces, perhaps, in an infinite variety of combinations. For instance, is the sand other than the rocks? That is to say, is the sand maybe nothing but a great number of very tiny stones? Is the moon a rock? What we mean is, if we understood rocks, would we also understand the sand and the moon? And so, another example, is the wind a sloshing of the air analogous to the sloshing motion of the water in the sea? What common features do different movements have? What's common to different kinds of sound? How many different colors are there? And so on. And so we gradually try to analyze all this, trying to put together things which at first sight look different, with the hope that we may be able to reduce the thing and understand it better. A few hundred years ago, a method was devised to find partial answers to such questions, and I wish to give you a report on the progress to date in analyzing these things. By observation, reason, and experiment, of course, is the method that we call the science. Now, what I'm limiting myself to is a description of our basic view or basic ideas of what they sometimes call the fundamental physics or fundamental ideas. And I'd like to explain what that means and also what the difference, what we mean by understanding something a little bit. In this complicated array of moving things, you can imagine it's something like trying to watch a great chess game being played by the gods, you see. And you don't know how what the rules of the game are, but all you're allowed to do is watch the playing. Now, of course, if you watch long enough, you may eventually catch on to a few of the rules. The rules of the game is what I mean by the fundamental physics. Even if you knew every rule, however, you may not be able to keep up to understand why a particular move is made in the game merely because it's too complicated and your mind is limited. You must know, if you know how to play chess, that it's easier to learn all the rules, and yet it's very hard to select the best move or to understand why Alekhine did that. And so in the same manner, only much worse is it in nature, that we may be able to find all the rules. Actually, we do not have all the rules. We know that we don't have all the rules. Every once in a while, something like castling or something is going on that we still don't understand. But aside from not knowing all the rules, what we really can explain in terms of those rules is very, very limited. Because in almost all situations, like the man standing at the seashore, the situation is so enormously complicated that we cannot follow how everybody's doing all the rules and what's going to happen next. But I must say, I'm limiting myself, therefore, to this more basic, the rules, the question of the rules of the game, which I'm going to try to describe here. Now, how can we tell if the rules are all right if we can't analyze the game very well? How do we know we guess the right rules if we can't analyze the game? There are approximately, roughly speaking, three ways. First, there may be simple situations. In one corner of the board, there's only a few pieces at work, and that we can figure out exactly. And so we have situations where this nature is arranged, or we arrange nature purposely to be so simple and have so few parts working there that we can figure out exactly what would happen, and we can check whether our rules work there. Another interesting way to check rules is in terms of overall theorems. For example, if the rule of the movement on the bishop on the chessboard is that it moves only on the diagonal, then one can deduce that no matter how many moves have been made and no matter what happens, a bishop that's on a red square will always be on a red square. So without being able to follow the details, you can always check your idea about the bishop motion by finding out if it always is on a red square. And of course you will for a long time until all of a sudden you discover it changed to a black square. What happened, of course, was in the meantime it got captured. Another pawn came down for queening and turned into a bishop on a black square.